Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me on this special edition of Bang the Book Radio for Tuesday, June 11th. We're going to chat some college football with professional handicapper Brad Powers from bradpowersports.com. Win totals, games of the year, and now week one lines all out there in the marketplace. So a good time for us to chat some college football, some preparations, how to put together power ratings, all that type of thing. Over at bangthebook.com, we haven't started our college football preseason stuff yet. That will be coming here very soon. We'll do season win total previews for all of the college football teams in Division 1A. So that'll be coming your way over at bangthebook.com. We have started our NFL season win total previews, so make sure you head on over there and check those out. Daily MLB stuff, weekly soccer, golf, tennis, UFC, you name it, we've got that over at the website as well. And of course, as long as the NBA finals go, we'll keep covering those and game 7 tomorrow night in the NHL Stanley Cup finals between the Blues and the Bruins. Parker Michaels will have a write-up on that for us. So plenty of stuff going on. We're doing some more stuff on Bang the Book Radio here as well. U.S. Open preview tomorrow with Brian Blessing. Another edition of the Bettors Box comes your way on Thursday. So definitely keeping busy here. A lot of people just taking the summer off, worrying about baseball. Not us. That's not what we do at bangthebook.com. And that's not what my guest today does, Brad Powers from bradpowersports.com. Brad, how's it going today, man?
That's going well. How you doing on this fine afternoon here in early summer?
Doing very well, buddy. I know we're getting you here on Tuesday this week. A little bit of a change from what we've previously done in the past, having you a lot of times on Thursday. But good to chat with you, man. How's the spring and summer going for you so far?
It's been going well, man. I don't get, probably enough of a chance to enjoy it because, let's face it. When it comes to this industry, no days off. But you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. I love what I do. And it's just been grinding away here, getting ready in anticipation. We're less than 90 days away from the start of the college football season.
Well, and that's the thing. You and I have talked about these accelerated timelines before and how, everything gets sped up so much. And obviously our thoughts with Chris Andrews and the health problems that he's battling. Usually at the South Point, they come out with the win totals. Obviously with him kind of going through some stuff, it's been some different places out there in the market. And I'll obviously be very interested, and I'm sure you will as well, to see what Circa Sports starts to do, as they seem to be a very, player forward type of outfit there. And, we'll see what they do for the college football season next year. But again, like you said, no days off. I mean, you have to, if you want to take this seriously, you have to be prepared earlier and earlier. And I know you, obviously, the last time we talked, were watching spring games and doing all those types of things. So how advanced do you feel with your preparations for the 2019 season as you and I chat today?
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly frank, I feel a little bit behind. I'm a lot more involved with, basketball than what I was 3-4 years ago. So that puts me a little bit more behind the eight ball. Keep in mind, I was more football only, several years ago. But now I've honestly got into more and more basketball. When you have success, naturally your motivation is also going to be there a little bit more when it comes to the hoops. But a couple weeks behind. But it's June. I think by the end of June, I'll be able to make that time up and be right where I should be. With that being said, I've still watched about 25 or 30 spring games. I'm sure that's at least 20 to 25 more than anybody else in the industry. I'm set with my early power ratings. I've started my positional up downs and I'm through 30 or 40 of those teams. So, I still feel I'm way ahead of everybody else, but it's still a process and I'm kind of a perfectionist. So, even though I think I'm well ahead of everyone else and well ahead of the market, I still feel like I'm behind from what I would normally be this time of year.
Now, like I said, we had some early win totals, in particular on the big brand name teams, about 25 to 40 of the really big names that are out there. We'll start to see the group of fives leaking out in the market here sooner rather than later. Games of the Year came out 12 days ago with the Golden Nugget. So for Brad Powers here, what have you grabbed so far where you feel like you've gotten some line value, whether it's a win total or some of those games of the year numbers?
Well, first and foremost, win totals are tough because, it's your top 25, top 30 teams. I grabbed a couple of those early, Oklahoma State, was available there, right around six wins. And again, that was in New Jersey there. And I do want to mention that a lot of my favorite bets aren't offshore, not even here in Vegas, but are actually in the Jersey market. So they've been a lot more aggressive in, as far as releasing team totals and game of the year lines. And I'll also say a lot softer lines there in the state of New Jersey. And that continues. Maybe we're going to have to reconsider, you know, opening up operations in that state if they're going to continue to open up stuff that soft. But Oklahoma State, Michigan State were a couple of season win totals I grabbed early in the process. As far as game of the year bets, one team that I thought New Jersey really overrated was the Houston Cougars. Looking at them, I thought they were power rated about 7 to 10 points too high. So I got involved on some early weeks action against Houston. One of my tickets is Oklahoma minus 15 over Houston. I thought that was at least 10 points off. And then Houston was also a favorite over Washington State in an early game. And I thought, again, that was at least a touchdown, if not more off, where I thought Houston should have been at least a touchdown dog. So those are two of my favorite bets when it comes to early season. Of course, Tony Miller did a good job opening up game of the year lines here at the Nugget. I thought they were pretty sharp, though. I only got involved on a couple of games. One, Florida State being a home dog to Syracuse. I think Syracuse takes a step back this year. I know a lot of people want to, you know, throw the towel in on Willie Taggart at Florida State, but I think they'll be much improved in year two. I had a wrong team favored there, so I took Florida State. Nebraska plus 10 against the Buckeyes, an early September game, I thought was, you know, it wasn't real off, but I thought my number was closer to 6 or 7, so I wasn't afraid to take the plus 10 with what I think is going to be a much improved Nebraska team, a Nebraska team that had Ohio State on the ropes in Columbus last year. So I took advantage of that one. The only other, you know, place that opened up some game of the year lines was CGT in town. I thought those were a little soft. One in particular that I really liked, you know, West Virginia was favored at Baylor. I mean, Baylor's the better team this year, and they're at home. So I thought that line was off, you know, a touchdown or so. So that would have been my favorite bet, at least in town here, as far as the game of the year line.
Well, and it's kind of funny. You know, we've done a lot of horse racing stuff here over the Triple Crown period with Brian Blessing, and you sort of look for these things where, you know, maybe a jockey has a choice between two horses for the same trainer. He picks one of them, you assume that that's probably the better horse, at least if it's an experienced and proven rider. And it's funny that you bring up Houston and West Virginia as I, you know, draw sort of an analogy to horse racing in that, and we talked about this with Dana Holgorsen, he saw the writing on the wall at West Virginia. They lost a ton of talent from last year's team, had the transfer quarterback, of course, in Will Greer, losing some wide receivers. He jumped ship. That tells you a lot of what you need to know about West Virginia. And then you see that Baylor line, and things like that do start to make a little bit more sense. And, of course, you know, with Holgorsen, now the highest-paid Group of Five head coach in college football, you get that hype train for the Houston Cougars with him going down there. So definitely playing on perception and sort of reading between the lines there, a strength of yours, it always has been, and I like that those are some of the ones that you pointed out.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, I mean, look, I think the odds makers do a decent job, but what they don't fully grasp is the teams, the outlier teams. And by outliers, the teams that are going to make the biggest jumps, the teams that are going to make the biggest declines. And I think one of their weaknesses, at least year after year, as I continue to jump in on these, is I don't think they properly account for coaching changes. Look, I love West Virginia's new coach. I think in the long run, he's going to be better. And I'm talking Neil Brown. I think it'll be better than Dana Holgorsen, but I mean, when you look at the personnel losses, you're transitioning to a new regime. West Virginia is going to be not nearly as good as what they were last year. And I thought that was a mistake. And what they also missed, at least as far as the CGT line there, is the ascension of Baylor under Matt Rhule. I mean, 2 years ago, it's a 1-11 team. Last year, they're a bowl team. This year, they're even better than last year as they continue to ascend. I just, you know, in those early years of a coaching regime, whether it be, you know, year one to year two, year three, I just don't think the market's fully grasped the improvements or the step backs, the actual transitions accordingly. And that's usually, and if you look at a lot of my bets, and in fact, I'm looking at them here, almost all of them are relatively new coaches, whether it's year one or year two, year three. That's a lot of times where I find the value. I don't necessarily find the value. You don't see me getting involved on too many Alabama games and Clemson games and whatnot, when it's easier to have a power rating for those teams that are consistently at the top.
Well, and we're just going to kind of riff and freestyle a little bit here with some of the talking points that I have for today's show. And one of them was to touch on coaches. And it does make sense that you are looking to prey on those situations with first or second year head coaches. And you know, you would think from year one to year two, as a coach gets his recruits in place, gets his systems in place, pushes out some of those upperclassmen that you know, maybe don't fit what he wants to do, you do expect that leap from year one to year two. And I think the biggest leap, and you and I have discussed this before, and I think it's a very good time to discuss this now, the biggest leap is traditionally from year two to year three.
It is year two to year three. Although, man, I'll tell you, starting this century, at least at the top of college football, and if you look at it historically, you know, I would say over 25, 30-year sample size, it's year three, just because you got a couple of recruiting classes underneath your belt. But, man, I start looking at the coaches that have won a national title in year two. I mean, I'll start Bob Stoops won a title year two, Oklahoma. Jim Tressel, year two, Ohio State won a national title. Pete Carroll won at least an AP title. I think it was year three. Urban Meyer won a couple of national titles, one at Florida, one at Ohio State in year two. So, you know, I've actually started to look a little bit more towards year two than year three, but you're absolutely right. You know, if you look at it 25, 30 years of college football, it's year three when a lot of teams hit that stride under a coach. But in today's day and age, I mean, I just gave you an example. I mean, a really bad year one under Willie Taggart, and people want to throw him under the bus already. It just makes sense to get an extra recruiting class underneath your belt that year three is it. But I mean, I've kind of shifted a little bit there. Yeah, year two is kind of the year where I see a lot of teams make their biggest jump. I mean, more recently, Kirby Smart at Georgia. I mean, goes from, what, 7 wins in year one to basically a national title appearance and what, in overtime loses that game from winning a title in year two. I've actually, Adam, year two is the year that I see a lot of, at least the biggest jump. It's not like they reach the mountaintop necessarily, but as far as the biggest jump in the program, I see it year two, not necessarily year three anymore.
I guess we should throw some qualifiers on it because you are talking about teams that by and large do recruit elite level talent. So probably
yeah.
Year two for, you know, the big time Power Five schools. But I would say, you know, just to defend my point a little bit, year three for the Group of Fives, or, you know, even a team like, let's say Virginia, for example, where they don't really get a whole lot of ACC level talent. They're starting to now to a degree with Bronco Mendenhall, but that's where you kind of see it with the mid and low tier Power Five teams and the Group of Five teams that are generally rebuilding a scheme completely from the ground up.
You're exactly right, and that's why I do the show. Anyone that can push back with me a little bit on college football, and I definitely see their point. I respect the hell out of that, and you're absolutely right. And you brought up a great example. You know, Virginia made that step in year three under Mendenhall. I mean, when you got a bigger rebuilding project, whether it be Group of Five or, you know, not necessarily the traditional Power Five programs, no question about it. Year three, year four is when you normally do it. The problem is today's society sometimes doesn't give you that type of, you know, the opportunity to necessarily get it that far. But, yeah, you're right. And when it comes to some of those programs, I look at, you know, Western Michigan really ascended in what, year three, year four under P.J. Fleck is when they made that big move. So, yeah, I think having that qualifier, the elite of the elite, the top 15, top 20 programs, I see it in year two, everybody else more year three. Kudos to you for making that distinguish.
Well, and again, it's one of those things with the elite programs. I mean, recruiting elite talent is one thing. Being able to maximize elite talent is another thing. And that's a lot of times why those teams make those changes, because the guy who was there wasn't doing that, and they feel like the guy who is coming in can do that. So it does make sense. And again, you want to keep this in mind. I love the point you brought up about year two for the elite programs, the ones that have that reputation. Listeners definitely should keep that in mind and then probably for the lesser teams that have fallen on tough times or are in the group of fives, looking at year three as a big jumping point. And, you know, we can obviously talk about that a little bit more as we head on into the season. But, Brad, I want to talk about new head coaches here. You mentioned one already in Neil Brown at West Virginia. Transitional year here this year. Would certainly expect that to be one of those programs that does make that year two leap. He did have a pretty good infrastructure at Troy, but you know, now he goes to West Virginia, where, once again, pretty good infrastructure, pretty good base. Let's talk about some of these first-year head coaches, though. A team that's playing against one of your favorite teams in your childhood, Notre Dame, is the Louisville Cardinals. They wind up with Scott Satterfield. Now, Appalachian State had a fantastic program. He's got a lot of cleanup to do here with Louisville. What are your thoughts on the Cardinals heading into 2019 with a first-year head coach who gets the game, has had success, is going to clean up that program, but it will probably take some time?
It will. I like the Scott Satterfield hire. You know, I rank, you know, the new coaching hires, and that he's certainly out of the 27 new head coaches. I have him in the top five as far as, you know, grading them out. I mean, it's a B-plus, A-minus type hire for Louisville. I get it. They didn't get Jeff Brom, but they still got a really good guy. Now, I'm conflicted on Louisville. Number one, I mean, last year was about a big of a drop from where we considered the market, myself, just about anybody in college football, you know, had Louisville as about a top 40 team. That's where they were at. And Louisville wasn't even a top 100 team by the end of the season. I mean, in my power rank, they dropped about three touchdowns. And I'm not even sure that was enough because, I mean, Louisville against the spread last year, I think, fell short of expectations by more than two touchdowns per game. That's awfully hard to do. That's historical as far as the drop they made. I have Louisville as one of my most improved teams in the country, but even with that being considered, I still think that they're going to bring up the rear when it comes to the ACC. They do have 16 returning starters. I think they'll be much improved on the defense side of the ball. Number one, their experience, 10 returning starters. And they get rid of Brian Van Gorder, who was a disaster of a hire at defensive coordinator last year. So I think Louisville is going to be much improved. Problem is, I don't think it's going to be enough for them to really improve a heck of a lot in the win total column. I still think it's a 3-9, 4-8 type of season. And if you look at Satterfield, what he did at Appalachian State, I mean, he didn't have any early really success. I mean, he inherited a pretty good program from Jerry Moore at Appalachian State, you know, inherited an 8-4 team, went 4-8 in his first year. So he kind of took a step back, and then he started to build the program up to one of the better group of five. I'm not going to have a lot of Louisville tickets this year, even though I think that they're going to be much improved. But I think this is a team that I'm looking more year two, year three under Satterfield. They'll be improved, but not enough to really make a difference when it comes to wins and losses this year.
When you look at Louisville here, getting 20 at home in week one on Monday night against Notre Dame. Notre Dame, as we mentioned, very high upside, but they've got a pretty tough schedule here for the upcoming season. Again, we'll talk about Notre Dame as we get a little bit closer to the year here. Let's go to Kansas State, and let's go to Chris Kleeman. And this is a really interesting hire because you had Craig Bohl go to Wyoming, had the 1 year of success where Josh Allen, you know, played okay. The defense played really, really well. He's kind of been up and down a little bit there in Laramie, and it is a very tough place to recruit, a tough place to, you know, really put together a base for, you know, what you need to compete in the Mountain West Conference. So Kleeman takes over for Bohl at Kansas State, or at North Dakota State, excuse me, now goes to Kansas State. So you lose a legacy guy for the second time in Bill Snyder, but it seemed like he had kind of fallen out of favor with the program a little bit, didn't seem to get along with players. There were some negative reports out there. But he scoured the JUCO route very, very well. That's how he recruited in Manhattan. Are things going to change now with this new hire?
I don't think they – look, I still think they should go some of the JUCO route because if you follow college football, there's, you know, a good conference that's kind of based as far as JUCOs go right in the Kansas and Iowa areas. So – I don't think – I mean, that's going to change a little, but I don't think it's drastic changes. I do think, and no disrespect to Bill Snyder as far as, you know, age discrimination, but I do think from an energy level, There might have needed to be a change, although I'm going to miss Bill Snyder. If I had a go-to guy to back as an underdog, he was one of my go-tos, no question about it, for the last 10 years. But another solid hire. I mean, I don't give it an A, but it's probably more in the B+ range. I think that they're going to be all right. I don't think it's going to be, you know, necessarily a great season this year. There are some teams that are really ascending in the Big 12. I just think, generally speaking, you know, Baylor year three under Matt Rhule is going to be better. I think Matt Campbell's doing a tremendous job at Iowa State. And, of course, you got your top programs already in Texas and Oklahoma. So I think Kansas State, if you're asking me, is probably, you know, in that middle pack with the Texas Techs of the world, probably in a similar position to another new coach there in conference in Matt Wells. And also we just talked a little bit about West Virginia and Neil Brown. That's where I put Kansas State, right, with those three teams there in the Big 12, all with new coaches. 14 returning starters this year. They get a quarterback back in Skylar Thompson. It's going to be a borderline bowl team, just where they've been the last, you know, where they were last year, where it came down to the final game of the regular season at Iowa State. Don't see too much improvement this year. We'll see. I mean, it's going to be tough to really break through as far as recruiting there at Kansas State. And I wouldn't go too far away from the JUCO route, to be honest with you. You got to know what your advantages are. And with those conferences there, the JUCO conferences being relatively strong in that area of the country, I would continue that route there if I'm Kansas State.
I will say this, in terms of, you know, full season thoughts on Kansas State, I'm not exactly sure where they end up. I'll have to dig more into my research for that. But I do love the hire of defensive coordinator Scotty Hazleton. I think this is an under team on a game-by-game standpoint. I think they can find a way to slow down some of those very potent Big 12 offenses. I think Hazleton's a great fit, obviously familiar with Kleeman, comes from that bowl coaching tree, does make a lot of sense there on Manhattan as a pretty good hire. Speaking of the Big 12, Matt Wells at Texas Tech. I'm a bit perplexed by this one. I'm curious to get your take on it.
Yeah, I that was one. I mean, obviously, we just talked Satterfield. I gave that one an A-, B+. Kleiman, I give a B+, A- type B, maybe in that range. Matt Wells a little bit lower on that. Utah State had a really good season last year, but I mean, until he made some changes offensively last year, I mean, there was talk, you know, maybe not hot seat, but there was some rumblings there after he started 9-5 and 10-4 his first couple of seasons. I mean, hadn't had a winning season in his previous three. So, I mean, they got the hot guy off a really good 11-2 season. I mean, offensively, since he made those changes at Utah State last year, I guess it's a decent fit at Texas Tech, but there's going to be some struggles there. You know, looking at how Texas Tech's going to be this year, again, I don't see him taking a major step back, but I certainly don't think that they're going to take a major step forward. I got them right around 6 wins, 13 returning starters for them. It's an intriguing fit, particularly, you know, when I look at Texas Tech, you know, schools like Baylor, Texas Tech, you know, Washington State, schools that are kind of, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of a peculiar recruiting spot. You know, I want to look at ties, and Matt Wells doesn't have a lot of ties to the state of Texas. So that's why I thought it was a peculiar hire there. He had a solid season last year, but I don't know. See, that's a good thing. With some of these coaches, and the new coaches, sometimes I'm very aggressive if I like it, and I have some of my biggest bets. And then there's others like this one where I just don't know. So I'm going to have to take a wait-and-see approach when it comes to Texas Tech this year.
Well, and I think it's one of those things, too, for Texas Tech where I sort of like their mentality of we're going to try to outscore you, and if we can't, so be it, but we're going to try. And I just wonder, because the idea behind hiring Matt Wells, who did have some very good defenses there at Utah State, is largely to improve the defense and hope that you can keep the offense at some sort of respectable level, something close to where it was. I don't know. It feels to me like they're going to be caught in between where the offense won't be good enough and they won't be able to recruit good enough defense there in Lubbock. And I know the Big 12 is an offensive-oriented conference, so if you have an average or better defense, you can hang. Hi, Iowa State. But, you know, I don't know if this makes sense to me. I just don't know if this is one of those proverbial square pegs in a round hole. Like you said, we'll have to wait and see, but I'm very skeptical of it.
Yeah, I am too. And let me preface by saying I wasn't a fan of Kingsbury, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, he did inherit a program that, you know, was an 8-9 win program, whether it be under Mike Leach or, you know, even Tommy Tuberville had a team, 8-5 his last year. And, you know, after his first year, Kingsbury never got past 7 wins. So wasn't a big fan there. I just don't know if it's a significant upgrade with Matt Wells over Kingsbury. And to me, that's kind of a problem in itself because I didn't think of Kingsbury too much. I actually thought Texas Tech, I mean, everyone thinks, oh, they don't play defense. They actually were pretty decent the last couple of years. You know, they made some strides defensively after allowing 40-plus points per game in 14, 15, and 16. They're actually about 10-plus points per game better the last couple of seasons than that. And they were at least making strides on that side of the ball. So I kind of got their progress from that standpoint. I just thought they had to clean up some things when it came to, you know, game management and whatnot and games. And again, just not sure on this one. And I guess it's a tough place to recruit to. I don't know who you get, but yeah, I agree with you. They've been known offensively since Leach got there, you know, 2 decades ago. The intriguing that until Matt Wells changed his offensive schemes last year at Utah State, he was more known as the defensive guy.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Like you said, I mean, they were starting to make some strides. And, you know, I did like David Gibbs. I thought David Gibbs did a very, very good job there. Now you're sort of resetting everything on defense. All that progress that you made, you know, I think Gibbs is a guy that, you know, I think that he fits at a Power 5 school as a defensive coordinator. Now he's a secondary coach at Missouri. But I think he fits as a defensive coordinator at that level. And now they're maybe going backwards. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But it should be pretty interesting, to say the least. Speaking of Utah State and interesting hires, this is another head-scratcher. I know they've got familiarity with Gary Anderson. It's a fairly attractive Group of Five job because of the success that they've had. Anderson's tenure at Oregon State was a debacle. Not only were they terrible, but he threw assistant coaches under the bus. The optics of everything didn't look very good. This is a hire I'm not really enamored with either.
Yeah, and I gave that one more of a B-. I think I ranked it 16th out of the 27, so below average for me, even though he had great success at Utah State. And one of my qualifiers is, I mean, do you know the job? Do you know the area? And obviously he does. Well, very concerned, not only what happened at Oregon State, but he basically quit on Wisconsin too. So, I mean, each of his last two jobs, I mean, basically quit. After that Big Ten title game where they got stopped by Ohio State, basically said, I'm out of here, and goes to Oregon State, which, I mean, you could say it's a lateral move, but it's not. It was a step down, and he chose to take a step down. And whenever I see someone do that, you know, that's kind of a worry for me. You know, it's going to – I think Utah State, I will take a definite position here. I think Utah State will be one of the teams that takes a major step back. I mean, this is a team that won 11 games a year ago. I think they're going to have to fight, claw, and scratch to get to 7 or 8 wins this year. The schedule is very difficult for a Group of Five team. You look at non-conference at Wake Forest, at LSU. That's relatively tough, in addition to BYU. And then you look at in conference, they're at Fresno State, at San Diego State, two of the best teams from the other side, from the West Division. They have to play both of those teams, and they're both on the road. Yeah, I think Utah State, again, going from 11 wins to 7 or so this year, they get the quarterback back in Jordan Love, who's one of the more underrated quarterbacks in the entire country, but they lose their top 5 receivers. They lose a 1,000-yard rusher. They lose 3 of their top 4 tacklers. I'm not buying Utah State this year. Now, I'm not sure if I'm buying Gary Anderson's second tenure here. We've seen traditionally these second tenures, outside of Bill Snyder, who's a Hall of Fame coach at Kansas State, I mean, these second tenures just don't necessarily go well. I mean, it was kind of average when you looked at Mike Riley at Oregon State. It was okay at best. John Robinson going back to the 90s at USC, that actually failed. We're not seeing Randy Etzel working out too well right now at Connecticut in his second go around there. So I'm not buying it necessarily with Gary Anderson here. Here's one where I'll take a strong position. I'm selling the Aggies.
I completely agree with you. And it also doesn't inspire a whole lot of confidence for me that Mike Sanford, who's now the offensive coordinator here, things did not work out well for him when he took over there at Western Kentucky. So also, this is one of those situations where you want to factor things like this into the construction of your power ratings. I think this is a good time to sort of pivot to that for a couple of minutes, because Utah State was this very explosive offense. They were a very balanced attack as well. You know, ran for about 290, passed for about 290. You know, they did a very, very good job all around with all facets of the offensive side of the game. Jordan Love wound up becoming a serious playmaker for that team. Well, okay, fine. They go from Gary Anderson to Matt Wells. So you figure there's not a whole lot of changing with the scheme, the playbook, everything like that. But Wells evolved as a coordinator, as a quarterback, or as a head coach, with everything regarding that offense. He evolved. And now I think you're going back in time a decade. The game's not played the same way. So I think from a power rating standpoint, this has a substantial impact on Utah State's offense, on all three of the skill position groups, probably on the offensive line as well, which will probably be more, I would think, of a power rushing attack now with Anderson back in the mix. This changes everything for Utah State. I think you want that reflected in your power ratings. And with you taking a position against them, it sounds like you have that same mindset.
Yeah, I mean, number one, even if Wells was still there, I mean, and this is a good point you bring up. I mean, I like fading historical outliers. I mean, Utah State last year averaged 47.5 points per game. I mean, it just doesn't get really any better than that. I mean, from them in their school history, and nearly 500 yards per game. So, I mean, I was going to slightly downgrade Utah State to begin with, especially with only two returning starters, only two on offense to begin with. So, and the fact that they're changing schemes on top of that, and probably, you know, what really helped Utah State last year, I mean, they really went up tempo, and it really caught a lot of people off guard, including Michigan State in that opener where they almost beat the Spartans. And again, they're going to go less tempo this year. You're right, taking a step back to what college offenses have been about here the last 5 to 10 years. Yeah, I would say my biggest downgrade for Utah State would be on the offense side of the ball. Here's an offense, again, that averaged, you know, 47.5 points per game last year. If I had to say, you know, what would they average this year with only two returning starters, you know, a tough schedule, I mean, I think that number comes down by nearly two touchdowns per game. So there's no question about it. And when I'm doing my positional, you know, up-downs for the offensive positions outside of quarterback, massive downgrades across the board on the Utah State offense.
Well, and again, it's very important to keep that in mind. With coordinators that may go with more tempo, may go with less tempo, head coaching changes, these have a direct correlation to your power ratings if you create them by position groups, because those groups either won't be as productive or maybe won't be used in the same capacity, which brings us to Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech, of course, running the triple option under Paul Johnson. Now it's Jeff Collins. Maybe that hire works out. Obviously, we have to give them a long leash for this one, because he's completely rebuilding the offense this team has. They will no longer be an option team. And also, without the option, you expose a defense that's been kind of average, you know, from a ball control standpoint. Now they're going to face more plays against, stuff like that. So, you know, Georgia Tech is one where I could see all sides of the coin. I could see people saying, you know what, I'm going to wait and see with this team. I'm going to wait and see what Jeff Collins does. I could see people saying, they're completely reinventing, not even reinventing the wheel, they're rebuilding the entire car with this offense. So I can see people wanting to fade them because of that. What's Brad Powers' take on Georgia Tech with new head coach Jeff Collins?
Well, generally speaking, I like the hire. I mean, I thought Jeff Collins, you know, inherited a relatively tough spot at Temple. I mean, Temple was historically good under Matt Rhule, and I thought Jeff Collins did a pretty good job in that regard. And one thing I start to look at, especially now that we're, you know, almost 6 months into this, is I start looking at how the new coaches are doing in recruiting. Obviously, not necessarily what just happened on February when they only had, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to sign a class, but I'm looking towards next year and what's the buzz? I mean, in today's day and age with social media and whatnot, I want to see how the 16, 17-year-old kids are grasping this coaching staff. And Georgia Tech's doing really well on the recruiting front. So I think the future of Georgia Tech football is good, but that's way off in the distance future. I think the immediate future that we talk about, I just talked about Utah State taking a major step back. I think Georgia Tech's a team that makes takes a major step back. Starts, you know, overall experience, only 9 returning starters. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing that, you know, when you're completely changing and reinventing the wheel here, I'm not sure that you wanted a necessarily experienced team, because it really wouldn't matter that since you're running entirely different schemes. You know, look, Georgia Tech had been pretty successful under Paul Johnson. I get it got a little stale in 3 of the last 4 years, but, I mean, generally speaking, when you went to a couple of Orange Bowls, you were in ACC championship games. I mean, I would have deemed, you know, the decade under Paul Johnson to be pretty successful for the Yellow Jackets. Now, if they want to take an extra step, or at least, you know, be more similar to everyone else in college football, I think the Jeff Collins hire will work. And, you know, tying back to what we talked about at the start of the show about, you know, I made the position, you know, when you're a top program, it's year 2. You said, no. And correctly so, group of 5 and maybe not the blue bloods of the sport is probably year 3. I think this is year 3 at minimum, maybe even year 4, where we can truly judge Jeff Collins. Pure power rankings, my early power rankings, I mean, I took Georgia Tech down about 10 points compared to where they were a year ago, and not only because of the inexperience, but the schematic changes for them. Now, I think they're a bottom-level ACC team at best. I mean, right, them and Louisville are right there near the bottom in that conference. I would be absolutely stunned if Georgia Tech got to a bowl game this year. I think they're more as a, you know, 4 or 5 win team at best. I think they'll get murdered in week 1. I would take a position on Clemson minus the 33.5, even though it's a conference opener. Yeah, I think it'll be a real big time struggle this year for Georgia Tech. But please, I'm not grading Jeff Collins no matter what really happens this year. If he goes 2-10, I'm not going to necessarily have a lot of red flags for him. If he gets to 6-6, I mean, it'd be major arrows pointing upward. So no very, very low expectations for Georgia Tech for me in 2019.
All right, there are a couple more coaches I want to talk about, and then we'll get a little bit more into the construction of power ratings here and, you know, sort of the resources that you use and the ways that you set those things up. I want to talk about Will Healy at Charlotte, because one of the things that I've found that has worked for me, you know, from a season win total standpoint, from a game-by-game standpoint, is finding those teams that were really, really bad, really bad. The teams that everybody automatically and immediately discards, and trying to find ways to see where they're going to be better. Trying to find ways where you can buy at the lowest price point possible. Charlotte, one of those teams, to some degree, Coastal Carolina, one of those teams as well. And I also think Texas State. So those are the 3 that we'll talk about here as we finish up some of these new coaches. But Will Healy from Austin Peay, a team that was absolutely awful at FCS, built up a respectable program. Now he's a head coach at 34 years old for the Charlotte 49ers. What about him? What about this team? Does he have enough talent there in place for this team to, you know, get to, say, maybe 4 wins or 5 wins, which would, you know, be pretty significant for a team like Charlotte?
You know, I'm conflicted. On one hand, I like going younger and dynamic, and I think it'll help on the recruiting front moving forward. But on the other hand, you know, I was kind of surprised that Charlotte fired Lambert last year. I mean, they won 5 games, and I mean, it's not like the team quit on him at any point. I mean, they beat Florida Atlantic in the finale, for Pete's sake, as a 17-point dog. I mean, they competed at Tennessee and Knoxville, lost that game 14-3. I mean, beat a team like Southern Miss. I mean, you look at last year's schedule, I think Charlotte was favored in only 1 game. 1 game they were favored in last year. That was the opener against Fordham. Brad Lambert gets Charlotte to 5 wins. I don't get it. I thought Charlotte exceeded expectations last year. I mean, they're changing schemes on both sides of the ball. I think that's a negative, at least year one. I think from a recruiting aspect, Will Healy makes a lot of sense. You mentioned he already rebuilt one program that was one of the worst in the FCS level in Austin Peay. Had that really good season a couple years ago at Austin Peay. Took a little bit of a step back last year, but no question about it. Really did a good job there. I think he'll do a good job here. I'm not buying it this year. I think a lot of times when I see teams, in my opinion, that unnecessarily fire a head coach, that comes back to bite them at least early on. And I think that's the case. I mean, if you had to ask me, Charlotte take a step forward or a step back this year, I think it's a step back. I think it's a team that goes from maybe 5 wins a year ago to more like 4 or 3 this year.
All right. I definitely see where you're going with that. And I think it should be, intriguing to see. You mentioned Charlotte, a team that did overachieve. A lot of people probably looking for that step back now with the scheme changes on both sides of the ball. Definitely something to factor in to your preparations. And again, you're not going to hear people talking about Charlotte or Coastal Carolina or any of these programs in the summertime. They're just not going to do it, which is what sets our show apart. Jamie Chadwell at Coastal Carolina. He's at Charleston Southern. Takes the OC job here for Coastal back in 2016. Some people weren't sure why, but it feels like he was a head coach in waiting for Joe Moglia, who winds up with the health issues and then decides to retire. So not a whole lot changes here at Coastal. But again, a younger guy, 42 years old, been around the program. Is this the stability that Coastal Carolina needs to make a run here in the Sun Belt?
Yeah, I'm fine with that hire. It's a B hire, so it's solid. Again, you're ranking the 27 new coaches. I think I put it 13. I mean, it's not like your typical new coach. I just got done saying, hey, I like Will Healy. Recruiting aspect, I think he's in a good area in Charlotte, and moving forward they'll be fine, but I'm not buying him year one. Here's one where I could see Coastal Carolina making a jump in year one under Chadwell. I mean, it's not a typical first-year coach. He's been there. I mean, heck, he was the interim coach just a couple of years ago for an entire season. So, obviously, he knows the players and whatnot. I honestly don't even really consider it. It's kind of an asterisk as far as a new coach, as far as I'm concerned. It's really not. It's more of an extension of the Joe Moglia era, who's still there kind of being like an overseer of the program, quote-unquote, I don't know, associate head coach / athletic director type of thing. It was a Coastal Carolina team that was really close last year, got the 5 wins. They got 15 returning starters. It came down to the, final game of the regular season where it's kind of a pick'em game against South Alabama, and they lose by a field goal. So they were really close last year getting the bowl eligibility. Now, the problem is the schedule. This year, I don't know if it really calls for it. I think the real important game will be the opener against Eastern Michigan. Right now, Coastal Carolina is, more than a field goal home underdog there. That game could be a kind of a swing game as far as whether or not they get to a bowl. They flirt with it again this year. I don't know if they get really to it. I got them with about 4.5-5 wins, some of my early season win total projections for them. But I don't think they take a step back. Certainly with a new coach. And again, this is one where you got to treat it a little bit differently. He's been there. He knows the player's strengths and weaknesses. He's already been an interim coach there for a full year. I mean, this is more of an extension of the program from what we saw under Joe Moglia.
All right. So the one more team I wanted to talk about, and obviously we have plenty more things to discuss. You notice we didn't talk about Les Miles or Manny Diaz or some of the higher profile hires that are out there. We got plenty of time to talk about those. Texas State. Texas State's been a team the last several years, perennially in that 125 to 130 range in your power ratings. They moved up a little bit last year, did get the 3 wins. They go with Jake Spavital, who's the third youngest head coach behind Will Healy, who we mentioned, and then Sean Lewis over at Kent State. So they're going young. Love the offensive coordinator hire of Bob Stitt, formerly at the Colorado School of Mines. You got to love a guy like that. What about Texas State here? I mean, is this something that can actually – because it's Texas. I know that they can't compete with the Longhorns or the Red Raiders or even teams like LSU or Oklahoma or, even Ohio State now at this point in time, the Lone Star State. But there's still tons of talent to be had. So is this a team that maybe surprises some people this year?
Yeah, I'm glad we were talking. And you mentioned, you know, Texas State being a bottom five team in your power rankings. I don't even have them in the bottom 10 this year. So I think it's a team that does take a step forward. I think it's a team that probably has their most wins since 2014. I mean, they haven't topped three wins in each of the last 4 years. I think they do so this year. It was kind of the year that the, you know, the previous coach, Everett Withers, was kind of pointing towards to this year, and it never got the opportunity. 19 returning starters. I mean, they're one of the – if you look at Bill Connolly's production, returning production percentages, top five in the country there. If you grab a Phil Steele magazine, you'll see his experience chart. Texas State's number two in the country in returning experience as far as that chart goes. I mean, I have Texas State almost a touchdown better than what they were a year ago. And it's a team that was, you know, relatively close last year. They were much improved. I mean, it's a team that went from getting outscored in 2017 by, you know, 16 points per game. Last year they only got outscored by a little under 8 points per game. So some close losses there. A team that, you know, lost to UTSA by 4, lost to Georgia Southern by 2, lost to Troy by 5, lost to ULM by 6. I mean, they were close last year to getting 5 wins or so. I think they get so this year. I like that they went young, a lot of return experience. I like Bob Stitt because he also has head coaching experience at Montana, even though it ended up being a failure. This is a program that I think you can find if you're blindly betting on Texas State this year. I think this is a team you can make money on.
Well, and of course, for a variety of different reasons, that week one game against Texas A&M is real interesting. A&M, about a 5-touchdown plus extra points favorite in that 34-34.5 range. But yeah, that'll be an interesting line to watch as week one approaches.
Yeah, it will be. And the problem is I've seen Jimbo Fisher's not afraid to run it up a little bit. So, and I believe I'll have to look at it, that Texas A&M might actually have Clemson on deck. So keep that in mind. When you're looking at it, I'm not sure I'd be wanting to lay 5 touchdowns, and they do have Clemson on deck, Texas A&M. And with the Spavital's, you know, experience, you know, a team that's going to be relatively pass happy, a lot of up-tempo, and those are the types of teams I don't want to be laying huge numbers against, and especially a young team, you know, with a kind of, maybe even a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. And Spavital, if I'm correct, was also at Texas A&M just a few years ago as the offense coordinator and quarterback coach. So now that I'm just getting when I first looked at week one, it was just pure power rankings, what numbers are off and whatnot. But as I get into the further handicap here in the next couple months, those are the types of things I'm looking for. And now just talking it through out loud right here on this segment, I'm buying Texas State more and more now that I think about it. I'll probably talk myself into at least leaning, if not liking, Texas State in week one.
Yeah, Spavital there from 2013 to 2015 was officially the OC in 14 and 15, co-OC in 13. And, yeah, I mean, that kind of speaks to the kid's acumen. He's 34 years old, and he was an OC at Texas A&M in 2014 at the age of, what, 30, 29? So
yeah,
that kind of speaks to what we're talking about here. And you know, that should help from a recruiting standpoint down there in the Lone Star State as well. So we talked about some new coaches. We mentioned some new coordinators as well. Let's get down to this power ratings thing. And this will be how we finish up this segment. I think it's been a very productive one for our listeners here so far. We also mentioned how coaches and coordinators will affect your position group ratings in your power rating system because, you know, a quarterback may see declining numbers with a scheme change, or you know, a quarterback may see increased numbers with a scheme change. Something like, you know, Kendall Briles shows up in your town, all of a sudden you're probably going to pass for a lot more yards. So for you, let's talk about the most basic level of power ratings here. Something that our listeners can easily do, something that won't take them months at a time, like some of the power rating systems and the things that you have. What's a good starting point for setting these up and being able to give yourself a rough number that you can use as a guide, not just at this time of the year, but also as the season goes along?
Yeah, I mean, not getting too complicated. I'll tell you what, I think there's a couple of really good power ratings already out there in the market, and I think if you take a blend of two or three of these, I think you at least got a basis. You know, if you don't want to do your own position by position, you know, going each position, you know, 0 to 10 and whatnot, and if you didn't do power ratings in the past and you're not, you know, judging from what you had, you know, last year and doing up, down from your power rating from a year ago, three that I'd recommend that I actually blend into mine. Now they're a smaller percentage because I have my power rings from last year. I do my position up downs personally myself, but maybe they're worth 10% or so of my actual power rating. I mean, go out and buy a Phil Steele magazine for $15, and he's got a good power rating to use in his magazine. It's called his plus minus power ratings. That's a solid number to start with. Bill Connolly, I think, does a very good job. Specifically, I think he's the best analytics guy out there in college football, and his power ratings are more looking at college football from an analytics, you know, the scoring opportunities, havoc rates, and whatnot. You know, blend his S&P, you know, ratings that are out there for free. You can just look for his. And then, you know, another one that's halfway decent, you know, and if you don't want to use them, here's one that I would or would not. Is, you know, ESPN's FPI is decent. I mean, why do I think it's decent? Because when they developed it 5-6 years ago, I mean, they reached out to Phil Steele on how to come up with a power rating. And, you know, I was working at Phil Steele at that time, and we kind of gave him a basis. So I think that's a decent one. You do a blend of those three and come up with an average, I think you got a good starting out point as far as a power rating. You can also look at mine. I mean, I post my power rating for free out there. I mean, I would like to think that I have the best, but if you don't believe in me, then that's fine. You know, use a blend of those. And then I also think the guy that I'm talking to, Adam Burke, does a good job when he comes up with his power rating. So, you know, just using a blend of those 3 to 4 or 5 sources, I think you got a good power rating there just using them without doing really a lot of work, to be honest with you.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, man, and I do rely on yours and take a look at yours when they're posted to help with mine. And that's an important thing here, too. You know, not only crowdsourcing, because it'll keep you – it's an inherent control. It'll keep you from being way too high or way too low on a team when you sort of get that crowdsourced opinion of it, so you don't wind up losing a bunch of money playing games of the year on somebody or, you know, their under-season win total or, you know, something during the season. But also – a lot of our listeners, I imagine 99.9% of our listeners are not in a position to bet the week one lines that are out there, not in a position to bet the games of the year, not in a position to bet season win totals. But that information is out there, and that can be a guide. That can be a blueprint for you as you start putting together your power ratings. You know, on opening night, let's say you've got Arizona, a 17-point favorite against Hawaii on the road. Well, something's probably a little bit too optimistic with your Arizona projection, or maybe you're too low on Hawaii. So you can cut it down a little bit, get a little bit closer to that market number of 11.5. That guide is already out there for you. And maybe it doesn't help you for week two or week three, something like that. But with the games of the year, at least you can have a good idea for those elite level teams and can kind of branch off and build off from there. So even if you're not able to bet into these numbers as of yet, use them as a guide at this point in time to start setting up your own preseason research as we get closer to the year.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point. And I'm just going to tell you, there are a lot, the numbers that are out there right now, at least for week one, I mean, in my power rankings that I have right now, I don't have a single game that's off a touchdown. I mean, my edges are like 3-4 points. Maybe if it's a big spread, like a 5-touchdown spread, maybe I'm off 4 or 5, but I can tell you, they're relatively sharp right now. The line's already in week one. This isn't one bookmaker, like, you know, with all due respect, Chris Andrews, just one bookmaker coming out with his own lines on one thing. I mean, it's relatively apparent that the market right now has crowdsourced all those free power ratings and all the information that's already out there. And they've come up with some pretty good lines. Not saying that there's not opportunities to get involved here, but they're relatively sharp. So if you want to base your power ratings off some of them early numbers that are already out there, Adam made a great point there. You can definitely build that. And anytime you're off more than a touchdown, I'm not saying that the line can't be off a little bit, but if you're off more than a touchdown from what the market is, I would say – it's your problem, not necessarily the market, because in the course of a season, I don't see my numbers off that much, hardly in any single game. It's not the case anymore when it comes to college football.
Right, and that's not to say that you want to be a copycat with your power ratings. It's not to say that you don't want to take some positions and have some stances against teams, but you also want to keep in mind that if you've got a big stance in week one and week two and you're 0-2 against the spread, you probably want to adjust a little bit quicker as the season goes along. So don't be afraid to take those positions, but you know, keep them in mind. Sometimes you're going to be right and your positions are going to be accurate, and then all of a sudden the market's going to look like you 3 weeks into the year, but also there's a chance that you're going to be wrong and you're going to look like the market 2 weeks into the year. So again, it's all about finding that balance, but don't be afraid to trust your research. And I know that this is something that you've really developed and honed as you've gotten more invested in the industry, as you've transitioned from doing the steel side to doing the handicapping and betting side. You trust yourself probably a lot more than you did at the outset. And that's an important thing for our listeners here, is that this is a multi-year process, getting power ratings that you like, that you're comfortable with, and then having the confidence to bet based on your numbers. And it's all part of that learning curve in this business.
You make several good points. Starting off, you know, generally speaking, I mean, after weeks one and week two, even though I really love my power ratings, I think they're the best, I should feel that way, considering my experience and my past success. But we, after the early week games, I am so much more, adept as far as, you know, making significant changes to my power rank, because I could be flat out right on a team or I could be flat out wrong. And I'm very aggressive when it comes to making power ratings changes early on the season, much more than what I am come week six, week seven. And of course, at the end of the season, when we just have more data points to look at something. So even a guy like myself, you know, there's going to be select teams where I'm making major adjustments up or down after the first couple weeks of the season, and usually after week two more than anything, because anything can happen in just a one-game sample size. But you're right. It is – I would say my power ratings are so much stronger right now than what they were 3-4 years ago. You know, and there's going to be, you know, a certain point where I just don't – I mean, I would like to think that they continue to get better and better and sharper, but we'll see as we move along here. But certainly – my biggest area of growth has been in the last four or five years, you know, knowing what sources to trust and what not are a big thing, you know, because there's a lot of free information out there, but be very careful of who to trust and who not to. And then I just told you some sources that I trust, that I incorporate into my power ranks, and that's kind of been by trial and error, you know, what sources that have worked for me, what have not. It's certainly, if you're starting off with power ratings, you know, don't beat yourself up too much about it. I mean, it's certainly a process to move along here. But, you're certainly going to be better in year three, year four, than what you would be starting off with it. I know that's been the case with me.
Brad Powers, professional handicapper over at bradpowerssports.com. Your Powers Picks newsletter it's the greatest value in the business because of the information that you share, because of the low price point that's out there. So I highly recommend everybody check that out. What else is going on over at the website, man?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought about, talked about that newsletter. I'm working on it right now, and I'm trying to get this thing pumped out today. It'll be my latest one, and if you want to see my early power ratings, I'll post all the teams, 1 through 130. That'll be my early power ranks. Not to say that I won't make some at-point adjustments as we move along towards the summer. You got to take into consideration injuries and suspensions and whatnot, but I'll have my early power ranks posted for all of the teams. That'll be available for free, along with my early lines on all the games. Again, for free. All my off-season issues you can download for free at bradpowersports.com. And if you like what you see, say, hey, this guy, at least, you know, he doesn't only talk a good game, but it looks like he puts in the time and effort. If you want to sign up for the season, the newsletter is $79. You get an email to you weekly. Covers college and the NFL. I get it. We're in a wins and losses business. So, I mean, the last 4 years, if you just play on my newsletter picks, usually have five in college each week, three in the NFL. I mean, we're talking a 600-plus game sample size here, 57%. And I know a lot of people advertise 70, 80, 90% winners, sell your house, sell your, you know, wife, sell your kids. 57% is pretty good in this industry with that kind of sample size. It's by far the number one newsletter in the nation when it comes to the weekly ones, you know, whether it be the power sweeps, the Mark Lawrence's playbooks of the world. we lap the field when it comes to that. But don't buy it for the wins and losses. Buy it for the information. $79, that covers you all the way through the Super Bowl. Email to you weekly. And, again, if you just want to check it out, you can download all the off-season issues for free. And, again, as we're taping this on Tuesday, by Tuesday night I should have the newest issue up there available for free. BradPowerSports.com.
And at Brad Powers and the number 7 on Twitter. I love chatting with you, brother. I miss you, man. I can't wait to dig into the daily shows here once we get into the month of August. It's been great to chat with you, brother. I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer. We'll get you on here again soon, and take care of yourself, man.
Yeah, right back at you, man. It was always a pleasure to talk to you and all the listeners out there.
There you go. There's Brad Powers, professional handicapper, at BradPowersSports.com, at Brad Powers, and the number 7 on Twitter. On Wednesday on Bang the Book Radio, I'll chat with Brian Blessing about the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach here coming up Thursday through Sunday. Then on Thursday, have another edition of the Bettors Box, my MLB betting podcast. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.